Well, hi, everybody. I'm Stephen Carter, and I'd like to welcome you to session number 366, BASH, Mormonizing Euripides. Our presenter is going to be Di Newman. Di holds degrees in linguistics and library science and has worked professionally as a librarian. Currently, he is pursuing education in religion and culture at the University of Utah. And he's presented at other conferences on intellectual freedom as applied to religion and intersections between popular culture and religion. It sounds like you should be writing for a magazine.
Well, I think we should close the door.
We should, and it might be the people in the hallway, the service hallway as well. So he's going to present his paper, and then after that, we will take questions from the audience. If you would come up to the microphone to present your questions, that way everybody in our television audience can hear you. So wait for Margaret to get back, and then we will start.
Beautiful. Last September, hours before the performance was scheduled to take place, BYU decided to cancel the University of Utah's Classical Greek Theater Festival production of Euripides' The Bacchae. That was to run in Provo. The official statement included this explanation: the Bacchae itself presents difficult material, and the approach of this production could be problematic for members of our audience. Since the play was on a last-minute announcement, the difficult material line is suspect, despite the Bacchae being perhaps the most disturbing of all Greek plays. More likely, though, the approach was the issue for BYU's administration. Theories immediately cropped up as to the real reasons for the cancellation, usually focusing on the fact that the production included, among other sexually suggestive moments, a same-sex kiss. Commentators were also quick to point out the irony in refusing to stage a play that, at its core, deals with the quite serious consequences of blasphemy. I share this anecdote not to attack BYU in particular, nor to unearth its motives for the 11th hour yanking. Rather, the story points, I feel, to the way that we are still deeply affected by Greek drama. These plays, despite approaching their 2,500th year, maintain their power to shock us. If they can still alarm us in their more or less original form, how much more troubling they would be if they were mapped more closely to our own experience. Neil Labute did just that. His trilogy of one-act plays, BASH, previously subtitled Latter-day Plays, and now just subtitled Three Plays, takes three of Euripides' tragedies and modernizes them. They are timeless, really, but contemporary, and the classical characters have been replaced with modern-day Mormons. Neil Labute is known for his works, both in theater and film, such as In the Company of Men, The Shape of Things, and Your Friends and Neighbors, which construct some of the most unlikable of characters, and then has these characters do terrible things to each other. Labute joined the church while studying theater at BYU. He is often claimed by those citing successful Mormon authors, despite the fact that explicit Mormonism is almost entirely absent from his work, and his own assertion that he is not a Mormon writer. The lack of Mormon characters has been explained by Labute himself. In 1999, concerns over his portrayal of Mormons in BASH, which premiered that year, led directly to his being disfellowshipped. He was instructed as part of the process to not write any Mormon characters, an instruction he has followed. I have a friend who was also given the same instruction, and perhaps another thing to consider would be what is the result of Mormons writing questionable Mormon characters, leading to them being involved in church discipline, and then who is left to write questionable Mormon characters. Though, after considering the characters in BASH, one wonders if there is also a reason why Labute does not include Mormon characters, because he has taken them to the absolute limit. The three plays of BASH are Iphigenia in Orem, A Gaggle of Saints, and Medea Redux. Before considering each play individually, though, I want to touch on some of the ways in which these plays, in general, are in dialogue with their source materials. All three plays borrow more than their stories from the Greek drama tradition. It is a trilogy, as the ancient dramas were. They are sparse in presentation and actors, with either one or two actors sitting on stage the entire time. These individuals share their stories. There is no action beyond this. The characters recount the awful things they have done, killing their children or beating up a gay man, coolly and calmly. There's a suggestion of a listener, such as when the father in Iphigenia in Orem urges the woman he is with, but who does not show up on stage, to keep drinking the wine. Similarly, Greek tragedy had a limited number of characters and were based heavily on dialogue. The decision to reduce the plays entirely to dialogue might be seen as a modern way of recapturing the spirit of Greek drama. Obviously, these are not direct adaptations of style, as such things as the chorus is entirely missing, and Greek plays were not all talk. Labute, however, has opted to boil down the format to distill the power of his stories. Each of the characters slowly reveal over the course of their plays the things they have done. Having characters recount events rather than depict them visually is a common practice in Greek tragedy. The grotesque, horrible actions are not shown on the stage. We don't see Pentheus being torn asunder or Clytemnestra actually killing Agamemnon, and so on. Rather, most horrific acts are retold, either by a messenger or by the perpetrator him or herself. Maintaining such a trope clearly connects LaBute's work with the original plays, but it also interfaces with Mormon ideas on entertainment. As for the strength of youth, a pamphlet designed to instruct teenagers on moral issues declares, quote, do not attend, view, or participate in entertainment that is vulgar, immoral, violent, or pornographic in any way. Technically speaking, these three short plays are not violent or vulgar or immoral. The actions spoken about might be, but the plays themselves do not present anything prohibited visually. LaBute might be questioning such a position by showing us that we don't need to see anything at all to be disturbed, and that hearing alone often proves the power of imagination to conjure images far worse than we can capture with our eyes. So first, Iphigenia and Orum. In the Greek original, Iphigenia's story takes place right at the beginning of the Trojan War. She's the daughter of Agamemnon, the king, forced by honor and by his previous promise to defend Helen, his sister-in-law. Agamemnon marshals the Greek forces as their commander, only to get stranded without wind at Aulis, unable to sail. Artemis is not pleased with him for some reason and demands the sacrifice of Agamemnon's daughter, Iphigenia, before winds will return and the Greeks can sail. In Euripides' version, Agamemnon lures Iphigenia to Aulis, telling her mother Clytemnestra that Achilles wishes to marry their daughter. The truth quickly comes out, and after failed attempts at dissuading her father, Iphigenia decides calmly to accept her fate. At the last minute before her sacrifice, however, Iphigenia is whisked away by some god and the Greeks are able to sail. Clytemnestra, though, does not believe the story about her daughter's disappearance, or at any rate does not care, as being dead and being gone from her life make little difference to her. LaBute recasts the story of Agamemnon's sacrifice and his daughter as a struggling businessman who, worried about losing his jobs in a string of layoffs, suffocates his infant daughter. It is easy to point to the differences between the young man, who is never named, and the ancient king in position and responsibility. However, at several points, the speaker in LaBute's play compares his corporate job to war, including saying that, quote, a day does not go by in business that you're not out for somebody's blood. And he talks about how he loves the rush and fear of the battles he is fighting. Just like war was Agamemnon's business, business is this young man's war. The connection between this average man and a king goes further in Mormonism. Those men who prove themselves faithful will be known as kings and priests who have received of God's fullness in the eternities. Also, Mormonism presents a very patriarchal model, which includes placing on fathers the charge to preside over their families in love, to provide the necessities of life and protection for their families. Thus, a Mormon father is both a potential king and, in some ways, filling a role of a king in this life. That pressure to provide also helps explain the speaker's actions, a rationale, perhaps, for killing his own daughter. There is a strong emphasis in Mormon culture to appear good, which is often made manifest in material possessions. If a father's tripartite mission includes providing, and he is unable to do so, he is a failure. If no success can compensate for failure in the home, and a father's role in the home is seen as largely economic, what does that mean for relationships? What actions might be justified in order to provide for his family? A young man also explains his actions by saying that he saw an opportunity with the death of his daughter, and he, quote, hates to waste things. The opportunity he refers to is the notion that the company would not have the heart to lay him off so soon after he lost a daughter. The Mormon virtue of thriftiness is a fairly weak justification for murder, but it does fold over on the fear of not being able to provide for his family. His family consisting of his wife and several older children. Combine all this with the belief that sometimes the sacrifice of one for the greater good, like that of Laban in the Book of Mormon, is justified, and you have a recipe for what transpires in the play. A focus on saving face and looking good might explain the father keeping what he did to himself. His wife, we are led to believe, as well as everyone else, thinks the daughter merely rolled over, got caught in a blanket, and suffocated on her own without the nudge provided by her father. This convenient story echoes the story of Iphigenia being carried away to the gods. It is a story crafted and preserved by a man to calm a woman. There is an irony found in this play with the role of appearances. Despite having killed his daughter, the young man points out that he does not drink. He does not know, as he claims, what they say in the bars these days for bottom-ups to the woman that he is plying with wine as he tells his story. The adhering to the health code found in the Word of Wisdom after committing murder is odd, but the importance of abstaining is cemented into Mormon minds. As Heather Armstrong, former Mormon and author of Deuce.com, explains of her own background, in fact, I never had a cup of coffee until I was 23 years old. I had premarital sex for the first time at 22, but by God, I waited an extra year for the coffee. There had better be a special place in heaven for me. This is tongue-in-cheek, obviously, but it points to the role the word of wisdom plays in popular Mormon consciousness. The maintenance of what, to outsiders, might seem like a minor commandment after already carrying out an act that would almost be universally condemned raises the horror the audience feels. A father who is willing to kill his daughter but not drink wine suggests, at best, a relationship with the divine that is out of kilter. An unsuited justification for his action that can be construed is the belief in Mormon culture that the baby girl, dying before the age of accountability, will, in fact, be whisked away by the gods just like Iphigenia. She will, as we read in Doctrine and Covenants 137, be saved in the celestial kingdom. We might register horror at this explanation of a father's actions, however, we cannot deny that it has some resonance. This father may have damned himself, but he is still protecting, providing, and presiding in his family, and his daughter has been guaranteed eternal life. She might also be raised by her own parents during the millennium, so really, what is the cost of her dying? Such a reading explains, then, why Iphigenia is an infant here, rather than a young woman capable of making the choice to sacrifice herself. I do not intend to make light of these doctrines, nor to imagine that they justify infanticide. Rather, I merely hope to illustrate the ways in which a contorted mind might work in this situation. By the end of the play, we learn that the young man and his wife have had another baby shortly after Emma, their daughter who was suffocated, died. The man did not lose his job. Instead, a reviled female co-worker got the pink slip. The young man is now able to provide a comfortable life for his wife, other children, and the new baby, Joseph. That a girl had to die to make way for a man points to some of the more troubling gender disparities in Mormonism. This young father, we learn through various statements in the play, is himself sexist. He laments the increased number of women in his office and seems actually pleased that his tough female worker got fired in his place. It returns things to, in his words, the way they should be. Another aspect explored in this play is the role of the divine. Unlike Agamemnon, the protagonist is not driven to sacrifice by a god. Rather, it is a practical joke of a friend that makes him think he's going to be laid off. His friend calls to give him a heads up from corporate, and the next batch of layoffs includes his name. While the actions of the Greek gods might appear like a series of cruel jokes to modern readers, this is a drastic change for Labute to make. Yet Mormonism, unlike the Greek religions, has a direct chain of revelation. Therefore, the phone call might be a metaphor for the unbidden constraints of the spirit. Also, unlike the Greek gods, who are completely capricious, at least by mortal standards, the Mormon god will eventually be explained, just like this friend explains to the young man years later how the phone call with the tip was really just a joke. Labute does not remove the gods entirely, though, and replace them with a prankster friend. The young man at one point explains, "You thank your heavenly father for giving you strength to stand up to his trials." The use of the pronoun "his" is telling. The trials to which he was referring, the death of his daughter, come about through his own doings, yet he points to God as somehow the source of this pain. Interestingly, in Iphigenia and Aulis, both Clytemnestra and Agamemnon lay the blame on humans for Iphigenia's demanded death. Agamemnon points to Menelaus' actions as the cause for the war, claiming, "You're mad enough to want the bitch Helen back," and thus requiring the sacrifice. For her part, Clytemnestra attacks Agamemnon at being concerned only with a plan to preserve his position as general of the army with no concern for his own family. Labute inverts this order. Rather than having Artemis's will placed onto humans, a human's will is imputed to God. Like Euripides, then, he is questioning what the gods demand, what they send us, and what we can do to make sense of that. Placing these questions into a Mormon context, where the divine is seen as directly influencing everyday life, helps strengthen their reality. Unlike some other modern Christians, Mormons believe in a very interventionist God, and also, to complicate things more, assert that he is working according to clear laws that we can come to understand. The father in the play is faced with the gap between believing there is an order to things and not being able to understand it. To fill this gap, he thanks God for sending both the trial and the strength to cope with it. The second play, A Gaggle of Saints, is the one least tied to a Greek antecedent. Labute himself, in an interview with Times and Seasons, claimed, "There isn't really any Greek root necessarily to the piece, except perhaps someone like Ajax." Ajax is the hero of the Trojan War who throws quite the tantrum after losing the competition for Achilles' armor to Odysseus. He slaughters a flock of sheep, thinking they are his fellow Greeks, and then takes his own life. He is known as someone who is strong, fated to woe, and who uses force rather than intellect. Though Gaggle is an exceptionally violent work, the real Greek parallel that I see, though, is not Ajax, but the Bacchae. The Bacchae, as I said before, is the most troubling of all Greek plays for me. It opens with Dionysus returning to Thebes, come back to avenge the blasphemy of the royal family that has slandered his mother's story of her impregnation by Zeus. His revenge starts by drawing all the women of the city out into the hills. These women are in a maniacal state, having a literal bacchanalia. They are drinking, running wild, killing animals, and otherwise causing a ruckus. The god does not stop there, though. He confronts Pentheus, the young, insecure king of Thebes. Pentheus is furious that the women have been led away. A large part of his rage is grounded in what he considers proper gender roles, which the women have abandoned. Dionysus eventually convinces Pentheus that he ought to go see what the women are actually doing up in the mountains. But first, Pentheus has to be disguised as a woman. Thus, in a dress, the young king is led out of the city. He's carried home shortly thereafter in pieces. His mother and aunts, in a state of frenzy, tore him limb from limb. Agave, his mother, comes back to the city, assured the inhabitants will call her a hero for slaying a lion with her bare hands. Slowly, as her father laments reality to her, she comes to realize that the head she is holding is her own son's and not a wild beast's. The parallels between the story and A Gaggle of Saints are tenuous, but valuable to consider. It is the only play of Bash to have two characters on stage, John and Sue. They both recount the events of a party they attended in New York City while in college. During the course of the evening, the men of the group go off by themselves and end up in Central Park. Upon seeing a gay couple taking leave of each other, they decide to follow one and beat him up, which they do brutally, leaving him for dead. They then return to their girlfriends and take them out to breakfast, as if nothing had happened. To cover up the gore left on his tuxedo, John has one of the other guys give him a bloody nose. He even proudly presents the spoil of his attack, a gold ring taken from the man's hand as he lay on a bathroom floor, to Sue in a glass of water at breakfast the next day. Like the Bacchae, a group of single-sex individuals go off into the country, or the park here, and end up working themselves into a frenzy that ends in violence. This violence is fueled by a disgust over appropriate gender and generational roles. John describes being sickened by the men, both for their gay touch and because they are men old enough to be our fathers, clutching at each other like Romeo and Juliet. Similarly, Pentheus' stated concerns are that the order of things have broken down, especially in the realm of gender, as Dionysus has caused women to desert their families. Pentheus' rage might also be rooted in the uncomfortable position he is in with his own gender identity. Similarly, John's disgust at the actions of the two men might be a result of some unsettled questions about his own sexuality. Before they beat him up, John kisses and caresses the man, something his friends don't understand and question him about. He also wears his hair longer, despite his parents urging him to get it cut constantly. This minor aberration does point, at least in a certain breed of Mormon thought, to a suggestion of gender confusion. This is not to suggest that all gay bashing arises from repressed homosexuality. However, Labute has inserted this element into a play to raise such questions and to cause us to ask what about ourselves we fear that might lead us to lashing out. Similarly, Euripides has the blind prophet Tiresias and the former king of Thebes, Cadmus, explain to Pentheus that Dionysus cannot implant ideas and sins into a person, but only bring out what is already there. The attack scene in Gaggle is told in vivid detail, much like Agave's exulting over her prey before she realizes that it is her son. There's a shift in the style in Gaggle at this point. John and Sue have had short speeches, 2 to 3 lines each. John, however, goes on for 3 whole pages explaining the horrific beating. The horror that we experience, though, might be mitigated by the fact that John and the other don't even know the man they beat up. Agave, after all, tears apart her own son. However, in a Mormon cosmology, John and his friends don't beat up a stranger, but their literal spiritual brother, as each person is a beloved spirit, son, or daughter of heavenly parents. Also, Agave at least has a partial excuse of her frenzied mind. John, however, seems fully in control as he and his friends stalk and then pummel the older man. Therefore, his actions are entirely his own doing. Or, if we want to provide him any benefit of the doubt, an animalistic response to the sickness he feels at seeing the men touching. This brutal attack is carried out during a dance, the double valence bash of the title, sponsored by the church. Labute here seems to be making a connection between the Dionysian festivals and the Mormon church dances. The latter is a decidedly more tame affair. However, it is also a place in which inhibitions can be released. Such events are touted by the church as an alternative to more dangerous dance options, where young people would be exposed to inappropriate music, touch, and dancing. They are not a modern bacchanalia for most, but for young Mormons, they are the closest they get to tying one on. If, like the Dionysian festivals, they are necessary to release steam, Labute explores the darker side of letting things go to excess. And setting the dance in New York conjures images of the Babylon of the big cities, as invoked by various Mormon speakers over time. Much like the young man of Iphigenia, there is a clear emphasis on surfaces for this couple, John and Sue. John gets his friends to give him a bloody nose to explain the blood on his shirt to the girls, an explanation which they do not question, but merely accept. John and Sue also mention going to church the next day with his parents, as if nothing out of the ordinary had happened on the weekend. After church, John and Sue are on a train and witness a man backhand a woman he is with hard enough to give her a bloody nose. Sue feels John tense up at the sight and tells him to let it go. Why is John tense here, though? We see throughout the play that he doesn't seem to have much of a problem with violence. He beat up his high school boyfriends of Sue, in addition to beating up the gay man. Instead, perhaps, seeing others enact violence pricks his guilt. But really the key comes, I think, in the fact that the couple engaged in the argument are, as Sue states it, dirty looking, and they seemed like, you know, those kind of people. She leaves to our imagination what she means precisely, but the description is not lost. Violence John sees on the train is done by those kind of people, and he does not want to be associated with them. There is a large hole in this update of the Bacchae. A key element, the driving force, the revenge of the god from the original, is totally absent. One can make a case that John is playing that role, is playing the role of the hands of God. We assume he holds the priesthood, the power to act in the name of God, and he is punishing the blasphemy of same-sex relations. Such a violent response even received winking approval by an apostle in an infamous speech on dealing with sexual urges. However, this argument feels a bit too much like trying to force the play to cohere to the ancient version. Perhaps it's not best to run afoul the same mistake of the young man of Iphigenia in Orim, casting the actions of men at the feet of God and claiming they are his and not our own. Instead, the absence of this element does more. It shows the way in which these two characters, despite being Mormon, have a lack of God in their lives. And that lack excuses them their faults, though they will dump a boyfriend who leaves the church and will, as John says, claim to know the scriptures really well. Medea Redux is the final play in the trilogy. When Richard, in the film Lion in Winter, wants to insult his mother, he tells her, "You are Medea to the teeth." The attack works so well because of the horror we still feel when we consider the case of Medea. A bride of Jason, he of the Argonauts fame, picked up during his adventures, Medea is deeply dismayed to discover her husband's intentions to abandon her and their two children and marry a Greek princess. Such an action would have left her and Greek society completely unprotected. Medea, not taking this lion down, poisons the princess and then kills her two young children. When asked for an explanation of her action, she screams at Jason that she did it to break your heart. The distraught Jason, though, is unable to enact any revenge on her, as a chariot ex machina sent by the sun god Helios appears to carry Medea safely to Athens. Labude's Medea is a woman who had an affair with a high school teacher that resulted in a child being born. 14 years later, she takes this son to meet his father, who now lives in Arizona and is happily married. Shortly after this brief meeting, the modern Medea kills her son in a bathtub just to punish her former lover. Throughout the course of her confession, which it seems she is giving to the police, she recounts how the teacher loved Euripides as the most, what, humanistic, had, like, the most humanity of the Greek writers. This teacher was fixated, according to her, on adakia, perhaps a misremembering odd transliteration of adakia, injustice, the core issue of all Greek drama. She defines this adakia as the world being all fucked up because we just happen to be mortals. These direct references to the world of the Greeks at the end of the trilogy tightens the already close connections all three had with ancient tragedy. This modern Medea kills her child for the same reason as Euripides. She wants to see his father suffer, as she imagines all these tears running down, screaming at the top of his lungs, "Why? Why?" Though she also knows that no answer will ever come. Euripides' Medea gets to answer the exact same question to Jason. She does so simply with, as I said above, "to break your heart." She wants Jason to feel what she has felt, having been abandoned. Despite having the same intentions, the young woman in Redux is less drastic, more controlled, perhaps. She only kills her son, as awful as that is, and not her unfaithful partner's new wife. And she acts as if on a whim compared to Euripides' plotting Medea, who manages to find refuge and make everybody think she is going to complacently accept exile before striking. Also, Medea's hurt is fresh, where in Redux, the father fled before the child was even born, 14 years previously. In making these changes, Labute might be playing up the notion of a naive girl getting involved with a hero. Medea is foreign and supposedly dazzled by Jason. However, she claims that she is the one who dazzled by saving his wife and otherwise helping him on his adventures. The dazzling by both is framed in Redux with the youth and interest in learning of this young Medea enthralling her teacher, and the teacher's endearment overpowering the young girl. She describes their first kiss as one powerful enough to sustain the fidelity of Penelope. Labute might be trying to restore a gap in power and position that Euripides had closed with his version of the myth. Turning Medea into an overawed teenager who has to grow up too fast increases the mixture of pity and fear we feel for the young woman when she describes killing her son. If Labute is not filling a gap, though, he might be setting up a situation in which we can understand the vulnerability of a foreign wife abandoned by her husband in the Greek society. Without the protection and legitimacy of Jason, Medea is like a teenage mother left to deal with all the responsibilities of parenting. What recourse do either of these women have? How can they control their destinies in such extremities? Unlike her ancient counterpart, the modern Medea does not get a chariot to come down out of heaven. However, her fate is left open. She appears to be in police custody offering a confession. The viewer then is forced to wonder what her fate will be. She might go to jail forever. She might be rescued by cause of insanity or some other technicality. The gods, again, are removed here. We have only human justice to cope with. The lack of a divine stamp of approval, if it can be seen that way, that Medea received, shows the ways in which our modern system fails to cope with extreme actions. In the Greek story, Medea's hurt is somehow justified by the chariot. It helps us think that maybe she was sufficiently wronged to kill her children and the princess. The lack of such a thing in the modern world highlights that the law might be a blunt instrument for dealing with the nuances of a teenage girl processing an unexpected pregnancy. Of all three, this play is the least overtly Mormon. The character smokes and may or may not belong to the faith, and the closest we get is a reference to relatives out in Utah. However, the explicit question of adakia, the world out of balance, is one that Mormon theology addresses regularly. If the world is full of bad things, it is because of the fall of Adam, which made human mortals. Yet this opposition is held up in Mormon doctrine as being not only necessary, but good. A Book of Mormon prophet explains it this way: it must needs be that there is an opposition in all things. Because of this, bad things aren't all that bad, especially since they will give thee experience and shall be for thy good. This complicated approach to the good and the bad in the world might just lead a young woman to justify her actions to the point of killing her son. She might take comfort in the fact that bad and good are just two sides of a divinely minted coin. However, beyond internal justification, such a view of the world creates a perfect space for exploring the actions of individuals. Individuals are fallen, yet have the capacity for good. This play, in this context, no longer becomes a question of a series of mistakes, but a battle between the two sides of human nature and of love. The side that is protective and creative, and the side that is destructive and hurtful. Yet as mortals, we cannot escape these competing claims. The world, then, is hopelessly out of balance, despite everything having its opposite. In the first two plays, Iphigenia and Gaggle, Labute is playing on the currency of a Mormon stereotype, the successful happy family. This is a notion of the good neighbor who is orderly, friendly, helpful, and civically involved. Using this stereotype could be read as a facile critique, uncovering the skeletons in even the most spotless closet. However, I think Labute's use of Mormons is something more. Rather than exposing specific people engaging in terrible acts, these plays point out our own divided nature. Many, many commentators point to Greek myths and drama to explain why they still speak to us. They speak to us after 25 centuries because we recognize ourselves in these characters. We are hopefully not rushing about killing our family members, sleeping with our mothers, or being asked to die in the place of our spouse. However, there is something fundamental about human nature in all of us. We respond to Orestes and Oedipus, Jocasta and Alcestes. We often barely contain the urges they fell to. In some sense, we are all of us the picture-perfect couple and the gay basher, the successful man and the smotherer of infants. Thus, in addition to the ways in which Mormonism is informing the plays I described above, they have a more universal application to viewers. Every viewer can see the plays and be driven to grasp how fine the line between our best self and our worst self really is. The young man in Iphigenia explains to his listener that he wants to tell the story of Emma, his daughter, one time because it deserves to be told. Though he surely might also echo the words from Boethius Bound, to speak of this as bitterness, to remain silent, bitter no less, and every way is misery. However, he feels compelled to share his story, to confess it, to have it out there in the dialogue. This is more than a confessional. He seems to agree with Plato that stories save us. If we agree, as I do very firmly with this statement from Plato, what is the salvific value of these works? Phrased another way, do these stories edify us in any way at all? It's too simple to call them cautionary tales, things to avoid. I'm not sure I have an answer to these questions, though. I know the stories, since my first encounter with them years ago, continue to pinball around my brain, refusing to rest easily or be categorized. Perhaps, though, this is the value of stories that disturb us, not just these plays, but all of them, the reason why they deserve to be told. In hearing them, we have to internalize them, have to make some sense of them, and that process, whether or not we reach an end, is all part of the fear and trembling needed to work out our own salvation.
Very provocative paper. Enjoyed it very much. Now, if the audience has any questions in their minds, we would invite you to address them to our fine presenter.
Maybe we can have a conversation.
Thank you, Di, for that very thought-provoking paper. I'm not saying that facetiously. I saw these plays performed. I've read them first and then saw them performed at Salt Lake Acting Company. And like what you said about them, I think is very true, that they are moving but very disturbing. And I loved what you did with the comparison with the original Greek. When I saw them, I didn't think about the comparison of the gaggle of saints with the Bacchae, but I agree with you that maybe the Greek play that it fits the most closely, right? Has anybody else talked about that at all? Were you able to find any?
I wasn't, actually. I haven't seen anyone talking about these plays according to their Greek antecedents, which is sort of fascinating because two of them have the Greek titles in their
right.
name. But I don't think people have written about these plays much in general.
Uh-huh.
There was a session previously just at Sunstone where the presenter had compared Gaggle of Saints to Blood Atonement and the Nephi-Laban
right.
paradigm of one suffering so that everyone can live. But.
Right. The other thing that intrigues me is, so no one has really talked about the Mormonness of them either. Is that true, other than that this other session at Sunstone, at least that you've been able to?
Yeah, I mean, there's people who've done like blog posts, little reviews, things like that, but no one has done an extended look at them as either Mormon or Greek.
Interesting. So let me just throw out a question. Do you think it's necessary to sort of understand the Mormonness of it to really understand what he's doing, or do you think that the plays themselves really speak much beyond that? And then of course the corollary question is why the Mormonism? I mean, does that add something, or what is the layer that adds to it?
I mean, I think any viewer would come to these plays and be disturbed by them. In the language themselves, the attack scene in Gaggle of Saints is really bloody as you can get with just words, I think. So I don't think understanding the Mormon is necessary to be disturbed by them. I think that definitely just happens from their content. Though I think what the Mormon is doing to inform it, and why I think it's useful to understand the Mormon is what I mentioned at the end. This gap between the appearances of these good Mormons, the Mormons who go to church, who don't drink, and understanding how that sort of works in the culture as signifiers of being good, compared with, oh, I don't drink, but I also, you know, nudged my daughter and she suffocated so that I can, you know, keep my job. I mean, and so I think that tension's useful, but I think there's enough about them being upstanding people in general that the Mormon elements aren't necessary to understand. Like when the guy refuses wine, I don't think you have to be like, oh, he refuses wine because he can't have a temple recommend if he drinks wine. Though, as far as also what the Mormonness might be functioning as, I think it might be a way of for other viewers also with the sense of the other. And they can look at the characters and say, oh, I'm really disturbed by this. Oh, but they're Mormons. They belong to this, you know, John Krakauer faith where they kill people. And, you know, Brian David Mitchell grew out of this faith. So it might be a way in which there's sort of a sense of mitigating the violence. And it might be also, like, maybe questioning, like, if we other people, does that, like, what does that mean for us? And
I really like that because, in fact, I think it's interesting that a lot of times with the Athenian Greek plays that they would create that kind of otherness by setting it not in Athens, but you set it in Thebes, or you set it in Corinth, or you set it somewhere else. So it's a way of almost distancing yourself. But at the same time, that very distancing, the fact that you do that is part of the critique that I think is in the play, which I kind of sense you're saying about these as well.
Yeah.
That it isn't just Mormons that can do this kind of violence, but anybody can do them, and that's why it sets that fear and trembling that you're talking about, is that it's frightening to think that some everyday person that we could identify with could do these kinds of things, and yet they do.
Yeah.
Right? And yet there's this interesting kind of little irony going on that everybody wants to distance that from themselves. Mormons, too. We don't like to talk about the dark, right, at all.
Yeah.
And yet there it is, right?
There we make it.
I have a question. I was reading, I think, an article in the New Yorker. It was about the new horror. And it compared this film, The Strangers, I think that's what it was called, The Stranger, a recent film with The Exorcist. And it talked about how this guy's... No, it was in The Believer. It was about this guy whose parents went to see The Exorcist while his mother was pregnant with him, and apparently it frightened her so badly that she went into labor. But now we watch The Exorcist, and it's kind of goofy, but The Exorcist brought up pure terror in the audiences that watched it. And, you know, now we say creepy, but it doesn't bring up pure terror. And he says, what is the new horror? And he thinks it's films like The Strangers. I don't know if you guys have
seen it. I haven't seen it. What is it about?
I haven't seen it. I read a little review of it. But what it is it's about a trio of people who find a man and his wife in a house. And they essentially use the entire film to torture them to death. And at the end of the film, as the wife gasps out her last breath, she says, "Why?" And the leader of the gang, they all take off their hoods so that we know that these people are not going to survive. And he says, "Because you're home." And he says, this is the definition of the new horror. Demons don't frighten us anymore. Random acts of violence frighten us. And it seems to me, from what you were saying, that Neil LaBute is kind of perhaps a precursor, especially Bash. It probably happened 20 years before The Strangers. He was kind of a precursor to the new horror. But it also interests me in that it was put in a Mormon milieu where we do believe in demons. But what do you think? Mormon culture as a whole, are we more frightened of the senseless acts of violence that seem to haunt us in our urban and suburban lives, or the demons of Heber C. Kimball?
Well, I think, interestingly, not related at all, but I believe it was the Bacchae originally also caused women to spontaneously go into labor because they were so horrified when Pentheus' head was brought out onto the stage. So apparently this is a thing that's been happening to women since the Greeks. I think the random acts of violence are more disturbing to us because the demons... We have this notion that, you know, there's these powers that are against us, but God is eventually going to win. But beyond that, if a demon's doing it and we really believe in demons, we have a source. We can point to it and say, oh, you know, you chose in the pre-existence not to follow and now you're just opposed to me. You know, like we can explain it and make sense of it. Whereas, you know, people coming to your house for no reason other than your home, or the random rape in a big city, I think we're terrified by it because it defies explanation. I think also, though, Mormon culture is moving away from belief in demons. So there's also that as well. So I don't know if demons are less scary to us also because we don't really believe in them. They're sort of like the boogeyman. And so we hear these stories and we think, okay, you know, that's an interesting story, but it probably didn't happen that way. There's probably some other explanation or something like that.
We would be more frightened of socialists under our beds than demons.
Yes, yes.
Random acts of socialism.
I think it's interesting about the phenomena is that the adrenaline that surges in your body when you're frightened, that's what people are after, that effect in art, and to get you to buy a ticket. And we love to buy a ticket to get our adrenaline.
Well, some of us can't stand horror
movies. But the interesting thought about this connecting Neil is that he's so bonded in a deep way to telling these stories to be sold in Hollywood as, or Hollywood as horror based on classic art, which was designed to do what in those days? That's what my question is. Is it catharsis? Are these particular types of horror stories, were they used just to raise the adrenaline and sell tickets?
So you're saying, are adrenaline and crisis equatable?
It's interesting. We provoke it with a crisis possibility in our imaginations live in art. And we buy a ticket to do it, or we have a standard we won't.
Right.
But it's interesting how emotionally tied, because of our pocketbook or our job or our talent or our art, you know, how, or our freedom to be bound to tie to sell a ticket to go, woo!
Yeah. The Greek originals, I don't think, were torture porn in the same way that people go to see Saw for something, where it's just completely meaningless and violent, and we just want to feel that rush of, you know.
I remember discussing some of the other Greeks, but I can't remember why they wrote these or what they did with them.
What they did with them could be a conversation that could go on. People would pull you either way.
I mean,
right?
But political? Were they fear-jerking people?
And they do have political reasons. They have religious overtones. They have all sorts of things they're doing. But fundamentally, there is the issue of... most people would argue there's an issue of catharsis, that you go and see these things, and then it somehow teaches you something about the human condition, and then you somehow feel pity and fear because you can recognize yourself, and that somehow purges those feelings out of you.
Is it like football and testosterone and war?
Yes, it's like the surrogate war idea with football to some extent. I mean deeper than that, and I mean also there's the whole competition issue, that they were written also because there were prizes and honor to be won. I'm sure Margaret has ideas too that she could
share.
Well,
I'm not very smart, so I can't remember.
Well, I really think that you have to view it in the context of Greek notions of the way in which the competition around the plays was connected to the forum and public discussion and to discussions about public issues. I mean, it's not just political in the sense that you have a political statement to make, but for them, the plays were, I mean, they're intellectual, and they are about philosophical, intellectual, religious, political questions, all of the moving questions of the day that the Greeks were concerned about. So it's more, I mean, were they concerned with the entertainment part? I think so. Were they concerned with catharsis in the sense of let's get out negative emotions and that's kind of good for the populace? I think that's an element of it too. But I think you cannot dismiss that intellectual, philosophical aspect of it, where the Greeks were very interested in the public discussions as part of the democracy for what is it that both makes our society work or doesn't make our society work, and what creates the good life. It's the rise of drama in Athens, I think, is also very connected. There's religious origins, but there's also, it's connected with the rise of philosophy and the rise of democracy and some of those other things. And almost every, I would argue, every Greek play has underlying issues like that that are being discussed. I think the interesting thing about Euripides, as you were saying, that Euripides in some ways is the most troubling of the playwrights, because I think, and he's the playwright that is hardest to decide what is the stance that he's taking. I mean, with both Sophocles or Aeschylus, you can kind of say, well, it seems like this is what his theme is, right? With Euripides, it's, you know, is the Bacchae against religion or for religion? I mean, both are there. And I think that that's why they're disturbing, because it's a world where it's concerned about right and wrong, but right and right and wrong is not always clear, and it can be present anywhere. At least that's how I see it.
So it sounds like it was a vital part of the dialogue at
Absolutely.
The time to have these experiences.
Absolutely.
So it must be a vital part of our time, because I really haven't taken on the dialogue of people who want to watch frightening things, because we've taken it another step.
But I think Neil LaBute is more than that. I mean, I think at least has he done anything since Wicker Man?
He did Lakeview Terrace.
Yeah, he did Wicker Man, which is really disturbing too.
He's working on something else. I thought he had another one after Lakeview Terrace, but I know Lakeview Terrace is after.
I haven't seen Lakeview Terrace. I just think that in all of his, at least all the plays and the movies that I've seen, he really does deal with, it's not just that he deals with sort of the dark side of human experience, but a dark side in a disturbing way, because it's not just the, you know, these criminals that come in and terrorize you, but it's your friends and neighbors, mm-hmm. right? And that's what makes it more terrifying, is that, you know, maybe, you know, people that look good could be doing this. And that's terrifying,
right?
Right?
Yeah, very terrifying.
Question about catharsis, potentially. So I think an interesting thing you brought up is, like, that Mormons aren't scared of demons anymore. But also you brought up this idea of, like, opposition in all things. And because of that, we're not really allowed to be scared of hardship either. And so where does that leave us? Like, right? Like, if we're not allowed to, wallow, and we're not allowed to, like, and we don't believe that there are people chasing us anymore, like, where... You know, where'd we go?
Like, what do we have besides the voice of gladness in the gospel that we should just be shouting all the time?
And deluxe or boutique muffin bakeries, or cupcake bakeries, right?
I definitely don't have an answer to that, but I think that's a really important question for Mormonism in general. Just, and I would phrase it in the way of what value is the gospel bringing to us, really? I mean, if Christ died for us, why did he die for us? If he died for us and we're supposed to be happy all the time, it doesn't seem really to comport.
And if we're supposed to,
if everything's just supposed to be accepted and cute and, you know.
Right, we teach that this world we're here to suffer to learn, but then we're also not allowed to suffer,
Or even contemplate through art, which to me is really important. Yeah. To me, when Aristotle talks about catharsis, it's not just about catharsis because we've got to get rid of bad emotions, but it's working through difficult feelings and questions.
Yeah.
And I'm troubled in Mormonism about the fear we have of kind of serious art.
Yeah.
We want it just to be uplifting, as though something can be uplifting without dealing with really difficult religious questions like Euripides does, right? Or like Neil LaBute does.
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes like to scandalize people by telling them that the backslider is one of the most fundamental tenets of my understanding of Jesus. But I mean, I think it's true. We only want things that are uplifting, and we've somehow correlated uplifting with not dealing with violence, not showing that people can be bad. Like, there's this way in which uplifting is like the ads we see on TV for the church, like cute little family stories somehow, whereas some of the most disturbing things, maybe not LaBute, because LaBute, I don't think, maybe gets you beyond the void, but some of the most disturbing things are actually, I think, what teach us, you know, to appreciate and cope with life.
It's interesting, though, it's the Mormon gamut.
Yes.
What do you mean by that, Bill?
We got from the cutest to the scariest. Neil LaBute came from his background from a Mormon eye at BYU, and it's the same on the other side of the coin. It's the spectrum, the Mormon mentality.
I wonder if we don't have enough in the center, though.
Yeah, I don't think we admit that spectrum, though.
LaBute got this fellowship, and this other friend of mine wrote about a missionary having sex, and they said you have to. It was published in the Paris Review, and they told him you need to write to the Paris Review and ask them if they can, you know, cease duplication of this story. And he said, "No, I'm getting out." They don't like the disturbing.
Well, and I see it with my students at the University of Utah, where, you know, the whole prohibition about watching R-rated movies. I shocked one of my students by saying that I didn't think that you could be a spiritually mature person if you don't watch R-rated movies. Not that R-rated movies are good, but that it's often the R-rated movies that deal with topics that are about real moral conflict, and that I think often can be very redemptive. And yet we don't want to, again, we want this kind of little uplifting in the most superficial way that doesn't really deal with the struggles that you go through and how you work through those struggles. So to me, that's problematic. It's very problematic.
Yeah, I would.
It is definitely problematic. I had a sister who sat on a censor board in Albuquerque so she could watch it and tell people what they should watch.
Do as I say, not as I do.
I just thought that was the funniest thing I've heard. It's comical, isn't it?
It is.
I'm going to watch it to see if you can see it.
Well, yeah, there's that site too. I don't know if you know Screen It, where they watch popular movies and they count the number of times the F word is used.
Uh-huh.
They count the duration of the sex scene, so they can tell parents exactly, you know, like. So I'm out there, I'm thinking, like, is there a parent who says, well, 5 instances of the word, you know, fuck is okay, but, you know, 6? No, my son can't see that. Like, I'm fascinated by this quantification.
Well, what about this? They showed Rain Man at BYU, and they said fuck more than 26 times, and they took all of that out. They took out every little bit of naughty thing you could have seen, because it was a pretty amazing story. And they got so many calls mad that Dolores University would show an R-rated movie even if they took it out.
Even if all the parts were out,
that they would go against the prophet's word and show an R, and they can't do that anymore down there. Now that is what I call obscene.
Mm-hmm. I don't actually, my cell phone just died. I don't know what time it is.
I think we're at 25 after, so I'm not.
We have about five minutes left.
Yeah.
I was talking with Holly Welker the other day, and she noted that our current sort of big name Mormon artists were very interested in violence. We've got Neil LaBute, we've got Brian Emerson, and we've got Richard Dutcher, who all are very interested in violence and love to portray it well. Seem to be obsessed with portraying it. And during this discussion, it started to occur to me that you, when you said, where is our center? Perhaps the culture is such at the moment that it is very difficult to not polarize.
Mm-hmm.
Either you're, you know, on the Greg
and
Olson side.
Brian and Neil have both been disciplined in some way. I don't know if Richard has.
Well, I know what happened to Richard.
I thought he left
on his own accord.
Right, because he didn't want the censorship.
But wait, I said to him, the movie before, the horror movie,
mm-hmm.
where the guy's on the streets of Los Angeles crawling and suffering, that particular, after that movie, and he committed to making the horror movie and has decided to leave the church, I said, that looked like you were telling a story of your own soul being beat up. And he says, that's just how I feel. And he's drawn to that to show how the emotional fields looks physically.
Interesting.
I like this idea of souls being beaten up, especially by Mormon artists on the fringe and maybe perpetuating the violence by, you know, damaging their souls and then having them have to enact that in their work some way when if they've done something that's questionable. And maybe that could be partially explain the obsession that these Mormon artists seem to have with violence, is the mistreatment they've had at the hands of the church for their previous work.
But it would be a little bit hard to argue that, because Neil LaBute joined the church at BYU. A few years later, he did Bash.
Yeah.
Brian Emerson, his first work was Altman's Tongue, which was very violent. And so maybe we could, I don't know.
Yeah.
But there's obviously, I mean, like, Mormons and violence seem to me like to like go hand in hand, right? Like, our metaphors are always war metaphors, and like,
good point.
I mean, I think our origin is always very violent, like origin stories and things. So, there might be more
of
that
the overall culture too.
That's true.
You can't say it's particularly Mormon.
when there's so much in the outside culture that's that way. The overall American culture is that way now.
Cormac McCarthy, for instance.
Yes. The Rogue.
Yes. Unrelenting.
But it is interesting that we don't have Mormon artists who are very sexually who write things about very graphic sex, unless I'm missing.
Oh, you are. Well, you should come to the writers' group again.
Oh.
When you're back in Mount Monica.
Oh yeah.
Well, you know, I actually thought about including that in my paper because I don't know how many times I've heard people say, oh, you should see this rated R movie. It's just violent.
Yeah.
Like, there's some way in which, you know, beating children is, like, preferable to consenting adults, you know, showing bare skin. So I think that might be part of it. But I think there probably is, I mean, there's definitely Mormons writing about sex. But
not of the same stature of the ones we've been talking about.
If it's silenced quicker, you know what I mean? Like, it can be kind of violent. It's okay. But, like, the minute you, like, talk about sex.
And what would be the line between, like, where does extreme sex and violence, like, to me, the extremist forms of sex are violent sex, which I think Labute deals with in some of his work. So
The Company of Men is very much like that.
Yeah. So that might
he
also
certainly be deals a lot with psychological violence too.
Yeah.
Which again, I think, is very troubling but needs to be looked at.
Well, that was fun. I think we're at the end of our time.
Thank you, everyone, for coming.
Yes.